Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to call this a subcommittee of the House Committee on Revenue. And today is March 9, 2005. It's just a couple minutes after 1 o'clock, and it's important that we begin our meetings timely because of the amount of scheduled items which we have today. The first thing which we will do is we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2629.
Chairman Butler and committee members, so everyone remembers House Bill 2629. This is an estate tax bill that we were working just the other day on Monday, and it increases the gross estate value filing threshold for Oregon estates to $1.5 million in tax year 2007 and then $2 million for tax year 2008 and beyond. Now, these revenue numbers have been slightly changed because I got a chance to look through the 2003 estate tax return data as of the end of January 2005, so this should be pretty complete data from the Department of Revenue. So basically, when I go through that, then these percentages as far as the portion of the total tax that is really under this $1 million to $1.5 million, $1.5 million to $2 million threshold amount that you're changing here in your bill is increased slightly. So this is now going from $1 million to $1.5 million because, again, under current law in 2006, we'll be at the $1 million filing threshold for gross estate value. So going from $1 million to $1.5 million to be roughly 12% of the Oregon tax before, I think, at 11%. So that's a slight increase. And then going from $1.5 million to $2 million at 6.67%, where before I think it was right around 6%. So that grew your revenue estimate slightly. A reduction is $7.4 million in 2007-08, 2008-09, roughly $12 million in the outer fiscal years. But I did not request any amendments to this bill, so this is all you have before you today. It's just the revised information. And then, Chairman Butler, you asked Department of Revenue about compliance issues, so I think they're here today to discuss that.
Thank you, and we will call forward Vera Carringer and Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue. You ladies would please come forward and state your name, please, for the record, and we appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, and as you requested, Mr. Chair, I have a person who's knowledgeable about the compliance and administrative issues for the department, and that's Vera Carringer, who's the program manager, so I will turn it over to her.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vera Carringer with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I am the estate program manager. Mr. Chair, you had some questions related to compliance with the compliance efforts that the Department of Revenue does in relationship to a departure from federal law, as well as some assumptions that we have. And some assumptions that I just want to be clear about is that the closer we are to federal law, we do in fact rely on the IRS to interpret the statutes for us, to give taxpayer assistance, and to give instructions to the taxpayers in how to file. So that's an important piece in our administration of the tax program. Basically, it's easier for us to administer, and it's easier for the taxpayers to comply. Right now, I'd just like to say that I don't feel that we have enough information to know, one, if we have a compliance problem, and if we do, what the compliance problem is. Two, we don't have an understanding of any sort of compliance problem. And three, more importantly, how to solve it. I just don't feel like today we have enough information to know if, in fact, there is a compliance problem based on a departure from federal law. But I think there are some very clear assumptions that we do rely on the IRS to help us interpret the tax law again and give instructions to taxpayers on how to file.
Vera, how big is the department that handles the estate programs? How many staff?
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a very good question. We have three staff members that handle the estate tax program, as well as they handle two other tax programs for the Department of Revenue, the estate income programs.
So that includes the ongoing estate administration then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So three staff to handle all of the estate matters plus the estate income. Does that handle any other fiduciary issues?
The trust. The trust tax program.
Trusts following and the administration of an estate or all other trusts and fiduciary issues?
All the trust and estate income issues, but no partnership.
No inter vivos trusts, that's what I'm saying. No inter vivos trust. No trust between living individuals.
No.
Only testamentary trusts.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Okay, all right. How big was the department when we did IT1s and IT2s? All of the full program. Do you remember how big it was?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that was when we had a staff of approximately 10.
Okay. So,
folks.
And then during pickup, during the estate pickup?
And then, as Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as we began to have the pickup tax, and I don't have the exact years in front of me, our staff began to dwindle, and I don't have the exact numbers as to when. They began to have a reduction in staff. But I think prior to 1987 is what I'm recalling. I don't have the exact
okay,
years.
So prior to the last federal reform, before the current federal reform, you got down to, just during the pickup tax, you got down to three individuals and haven't ramped back up.
That's correct.
Okay, all right. So it was 10 during the administration, less during the administration of the pickup tax. Okay. And then you don't have any idea, because your staff is not working on any compliance issues at this point. Doesn't sound like to me. Is that correct? Are you out seeking for compliance?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay. So you don't have any idea how the three staff allocate their time in between the administration of the death tax returns and the administration of the testamentary trusts. What's the level of the staff? Maybe that might help. Are they? What's their background training?
We have one tax auditor, one senior tax auditor, and then one administrative specialist that provides support.
Okay. So one auditor and one senior auditor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Please, Deborah.
Just follow up on your question about what it was before, in doing a little research on this for the 2003 session. It's my recollection that there were about 12 staff, perhaps, before the 1977 legislature adopted the phase-in.
How many, I beg your pardon?
I believe it was 10 to 12.
10 to 12.
Before the 1977 legislature adopted a 10-year phase-in to use the pickup tax. And I guess what I wanted to emphasize is that prior to that 1977 change, Oregon's tax was significantly different than the federal provision.
Yes.
It was an inheritance tax and totally...
Yeah,
different.
It was truly an inheritance tax then. You had to determine who was going to inherit and the relationship of the decedent, and then file the necessary IT1s, IT2s.
Right.
And at that point, you were 10 to 12 individuals, Deborah.
I believe that's what our record.
That would have been back in the 70s and early 80s.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions of Ms. Carringer?
Yes.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. Appreciate this information. Colleagues, one of the things that we are asking the department to work with the Legislative Revenue Office is to take a look at the possibility of just a true connection to the federal, and to examine the total cost at the bottom end, so that we don't run into the compliance issues. We don't have anybody here today to testify about any drilling down for compliance issues. It doesn't sound like anybody's working on it, but I can assure you that it's going to be a problem between the $950,000 and the $1.5 million with regard to that. We'll try and find out what that might be, but in the meantime, my hope is that we'll be able to really refine the numbers and then find out at the top end what kind of a move we're going to have at the 8%, $5 million, which is the current top end of our death tax return, to find out what it would take to make up the bottom end if we reconnect fully with the federal, so that there's only one issue coming out of the legislature, and that would be that any changes that we make in this legislative session would be revenue neutral, absolutely revenue neutral. And I want to make that abundantly clear. We're talking about a bill which would not require a three-fifths majority to vote on, that would not raise any new revenue, but doesn't leave any revenue on the table either. So the amounts of money, and Elizabeth, you're estimating those amounts of money down on the bottom end, and now we're looking at the 950, is that right?
Yeah, Chairman Butler, as far as the total revenue impact, it was 7.4 million when you just go from 1 million to 1.5 million, and then up to about 12 million annually when you go from the 1.5 to 2 million. And I guess, Chairman Butler, maybe one clarification, because I did run some numbers as far as just kind of like adding, like a surtax, so to speak, a new tax on top of the existing tax. But this was to do it for all different income levels. And I don't know if that's what you were thinking, spreading it all
throughout the schedule.
Yes, and then having it be a percent of their tax that they would be paying, and then this would just be added on. So when you do that calculation, you roughly come up to about 12% would be the additional amount you'd have to add for each resulting tax for going from 1.1 million to 1.5 million. Then going from 1.5 million to 2 million, you have to have then a rate of about 19%.
So that the current 2% bracket would come out at 2.4 approximately at that rate.
Yeah. So the two that's basically to start your. Then at the end, when you go from 2 million being the beginning point for gross value of filing here in Oregon, then you wouldn't have just the existing law as far as that rate structure and stuff. You would have it slightly higher as far as that effective tax rate.
Elizabeth,
19% higher.
19% higher. So as I say, a 2% rate, or let's take a 5% rate, a 5% rate would then become approximately a 6% rate.
Yeah, okay. Like 5.6 goes up to like a 6.7.
Okay.
So, a little less than 1%.
Okay.
But the higher groups, like say the 16% rate, goes up to 19%. So it's a percent of how much the rate is at each level. So it's not just a set, 0.2% or something.
Okay.
I mean, I could run it that way, but this was just to try to equitably have everyone pay.
Spread throughout the entire
block.
I think that Representative Boquist had asked for that array, so that all existing taxpayers, all existing estates, picked up the full amount.
Yeah.
What I was interested in, and the array would have to have some heavy-duty numbers at the top end.
Okay.
So if you're at 16% now,
so you want to just add some new rates.
Well, and that's what I was asking, was that what would happen, but there are so very few, as I recall
right.
the numbers,
right.
there are very few of those estates that are $5 million and more.
Okay, well, or even above $3.5 million, you can say it's only 111.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And colleagues, my concern there was the potential for estate flight, the fact that the only thing that would hold people to the state of Oregon was that they were invested in real property in Oregon. But remember that once you move out of the state of Oregon, all of your intangible property then moves out with you, in effect, and that was a concern as well.
One other point with that, too, Chairman Butler, as you're adding new rates out here, you know, you're placing a lot more reliance on a few number of returns, which is harder to predict, you know, when exactly they're going to be coming in.
I appreciate the fact that my thought was if you're spreading it over 100-plus returns, it could generate exactly the opposite effect of the concern for estate mm-hmm. flight that the folks would then, if it took a 10% rate and made it into a 20% rate, then pretty quickly that could create problems. So we'll Elizabeth, why don't we have an opportunity to maybe work on that a little bit. Colleagues, if you have some specific request, I would appreciate that you would make it. Otherwise, we will continue to work within those parameters to, again, try and work something that is revenue neutral and either works within the body of the current batch of returns that we're receiving or to the top end. I want to be cautious of that top end. If we just end up with a modest, I guess we'll just look at the numbers and then get back with the committee, and we'll have another opportunity to take a look at this. But my commitment to the folks who brought us this bill in the first place was that we would not get it to the point where it's a revenue-raising bill, nor would we get it to the point where it would require a three-fifths majority to try and attempt to raise resources. In that process, we do have a couple more folks that signed up that wanted to testify, I'm assuming, in opposition to this bill, and that's Michael Deroli. Deroli. And then Jody Weiser, Paul Ritchie, David Bean, and John Marks as well.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Deroli, and I am the Oregon Director for United for a Fair Economy. I'd like to thank you all for giving me this opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. As I said, I'm the Oregon State Director for United Fair Economy, a national progressive tax reform organization working to ensure a fair and progressive tax system here in Oregon and across the country. I'm also a concerned Oregonian who is worried about what is happening in the state of Oregon. And also, just as I mentioned, I will be submitting my comments for the record.
Thank you.
I am here to speak against this proposal to essentially repeal our single most progressive tax and to address the real cost of such a repeal. Unnecessary tax cuts that hurt children and benefit only the richest of Oregonians are just that, unnecessary. To raise the exemption level of those who pay the estate tax to $2 million would be an increase of 100%. And cost the state of Oregon and Oregon's children hundreds of millions of dollars. So my question to you is, what would you like to cut from the state budget to pay for it? Perhaps the supporters of this bill have schools in mind, or perhaps they have something else. But let's look at schools. Oregon already spends $611 less per student today than it did in 1992 when adjusted for inflation, according to the state revenue. Revenue Office. Governor Kulongoski's initial proposal was only $5 billion in K-12 budget for 2005-2007 and included bigger class sizes, a shorter school year, less help for students who need it most, and stagnation in the achievement gains that have been made in the past 20 years in this great state. The governor's initial budget falls at least $300 to $400 million short of maintaining the current level of state support for schools. Our public schools have counted on the strong and active communities to support schools as state support for our school systems continues to decline. The staffing ratios have risen over the years by one or two students at a time, slightly increasing class sizes and forcing many schools to cut back vital support. So I ask you again, what would you like us to cut from the state budget to pay for this unnecessary tax cut? Under current law, of the 31,000 Oregon residents that passed away in 2003, approximately 400, only 1.3%, had estates large enough to require even filing for the estate tax. And under current law, only 65 estates in Oregon will be wealthy enough to pay the tax after the exemptions written into current law are raised to their highest level in 2009. There are approximately 3.5 million residents, with many of them sending their children to Oregon public schools. Until we have funded our schools and other critical social programs, we should not even be considering a billion-dollar tax break for the richest 400 Oregonians and their heirs. United for a Fair Economy believes that the near elimination of the estate tax will reduce state revenues by nearly $1 billion over the next 20 years. In 2003, over $50 million was raised by the estate tax in Oregon. We believe that instead of repealing the tax on multimillion-dollar estates, Oregon should reform the estate tax to keep 98% of state taxpayers exempt, ensure that family farms and small businesses are not unfairly taxed, safe care, Medicare, education, charities, and other key priorities. By doing this instead of repealing or nearly repealing the estate tax or raising the exemption level to a point so high that it is in all intents and purposes a repeal, we can save the state of Oregon millions of dollars and guarantee our children a good education for the future. I thank you for this opportunity to speak against this bill, and I urge you to look at the information that I've submitted for the record and vote against House Bill 2629. And when you do, I ask you to ask yourself that simple question of what do we want to cut to make up for the difference?
Thank you, Mr. DiVoli. Questions? Thank you. Next is Jody Weiser, Paul Ritchie, David Bean, and John Marks. You could confine your remarks to about 5 minutes or less total, and not repeat each other. We appreciate your testimony, and if you have it in written form, please submit it to the clerk. Jody, please lead off.
I want to just share with you some answers to some questions you asked the other day. Should have been this first page in your packet. It was like this. You asked about family farms in Oregon. And according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the average family farm in Oregon and surrounding states is $921,000 in value for small farms and up to $4 million for very large farms. Except, of course, that doesn't include something like the Ford Family Farm, which is one of the 10 largest in the country and is worth up $450 million, according to Forbes magazine. So, you know, you take a farm of that size and you average it in with all the other farms, and that really pushes things up. And you can see that a lot of family farms are not going to be paying any taxes. If you're looking at this piece right here on this page, you can margin around it. The small businesses in Oregon, these are statistics that come also from federal figures, shows that the average net worth for small businesses in Oregon is $741,000. That's less than our current exemption level. Well, the median is $200,000. That also is less than our current exemption level. So, obviously, most mom-and-pop small businesses in Oregon are already exempted under the 2003 estate tax reforms you enacted a year ago, or less than a year ago. Particularly if you look at the exemption, is going to be up another $50,000 next year. This second piece that you have, I opened to the back of a document. You might want to look at more of it. This comes from the Congressional Research Office, which is effectively the same thing as the Legislative Revenue Office for the national government. And it shows at the national level where the money comes from, that, you know, where the assets are that are in an estate. And you can see that over 50% is right there in stocks and bonds, basically.
So what are you proposing, Jody, that maybe we just ought to have an estate tax on stocks and bonds?
No, I'm not proposing that.
Oh, okay.
I'm proposing that small farms and businesses are not a very big piece of the whole on that. Mm-hmm. if you take everything that might be family businesses and farms in this, because some of the things like closely held stock may not be a farm or a business. It could be other kinds of assets. You add up, it adds up to about 9% of the assets that are in the states. So you shouldn't be exempting everybody with all sorts of assets because you're worried about 9% of the estate. And most estates, in fact, have assets besides their business. They would have their home and stocks and bonds and other things in addition to this, to the family business that they would have. Mr. Ritchie is going to talk about the effect that the estate tax would have on charitable giving. Anytime you make, you shift what you're going to take to exempt from the estate tax, you're going to shift the incentive that the estate tax is for charitable giving. Obviously, the luckiest children of the top 1.3% of Oregonians would be getting a gift if you make this change, and it would be to the detriment of the rest of the children and the health services of their grandparents. Also, I think we really need to see projections for a much longer time period than what we're looking at. If you look at the next 8 years, not just while we're putting this into effect, but look at the next 8 years after that, the next 20 years after that, the next 75 years after
Okay, we don't have a lot of time to get that far down the road right now, Jody. So
what you would do if you raise it just to $2 million is you would exempt 75% of the people who were paying when we started making changes to the estate tax law in 1977. That's a huge change for a problem that was identified. Thank you.
Cool. Mr. Chairman and members of the House Revenue Committee, I want to confine my remarks very briefly to a stand-in and less statistical presentation of the experiences of my wife, who has been a 20-year accountant in nonprofit agencies. And those agencies, each and all, received some proceeds from estates, bequests, and indeed, in some cases, willed assets. Now, estate giving can affect nonprofit operation in three ways. One, financial bequests from an estate while the principal of the estate is still alive. While an estate is being considered for ultimate disposition, people want to experiment. They want to find the most effective nonprofit agency, the most productive, and the highest priority agency that they can find. And so while they're still alive, they will donate to see how it's used and see how effective it is. And that's an important part of total giving for nonprofit agencies. Secondly, a probated will or a probated estate then may contribute substantially to the ongoing business of a nonprofit, non-governmental agency. And that really is a lifeline for their continuing, because a stable agency, an agency that does not have to allocate personnel to go and fundraise, is a stable agency. Thirdly, if the tax base is eroded in any way, shape, or form, then there are more public agencies that are going to do less, and nonprofit entities will have to fill in, will feel a need to fill in as best they can to cover services or educational services, whatever. Lastly, beyond my wife's 20 years of experience, I want to comment that as a grandpa of an 11-year-old at Jackson Middle School, I dearly want to sustain the state's support for education K through 12. And Jackson Middle School is a good school. I'm delighted. I remake that connection at my age of 64, and I'm fondly interested. Thank you very much for the time, too.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ritchie, Mr. Bean, and then Mr. Marks.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. I am grateful for the action that the Senate and House took last session in its revamping of the estate tax, and I'm somewhat disappointed in what I understand is to some reconnection with the
Mr. Chair. You can ask him to state his name for the record.
Oh, David Bean, 25-year resident of Portland.
Thank you.
I'm concerned with reconnecting with the federal state tax, which seems to be changing on a very regular basis. And if we're concerned about employment, then we're doing very good for the accountants that are adjusting all these plans as the laws are changing on a regular basis. I think what everybody would appreciate is a stable tax sense. Historically, the estate tax applied to about 2% of the population. And I believe that it's already at this point down to somewhere between 1.3 and 1.4 of the population. And so it is narrowing its bite on the affected economic benefit, which is to help equalize opportunity for as generations change.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bean, Mr. Marks.
Good afternoon. I'm John Marks. I'm from Portland. And thank you for letting us have this opportunity to talk with you a little bit about the effect of this estate tax cut upon the economy and upon us. I want to talk from a very personal kind of perspective. I've lost two wives. I've dealt with probate twice. I found it fair, just. It was a thing that I didn't want to do, but it's a thing that I was glad to do because I grew up in this kind of a country, and I was grateful for that. I feel that I've been lucky because I was raised in a depression. I have frugal habits. I have had investments in real estate. My first wife and I had a house which was appreciate a house and property which appreciate by something like 1,100% in the course of years. I anticipate being 86 now. I anticipate dying within the next 30 years, and so my estate will be part of the estate tax. And I think about the legacy that I want to leave to my children and grandchildren. The legacy I want to leave to my children and grandchildren is a spiritual one. Actually, I want them to be part of the community in which they're growing, to feel the responsibility for that community, to be able to proudly carry out that responsibility. And I'm very pleased to say that they're doing that right now. I've grown grandchildren at this point, and I'm very proud of what they're doing in the world. That is the legacy that I want to leave to my children. I want them to be happy and educated, but I do want them to grow up in a world which is a world of community, which has spiritual values rather than purely monetary and fiscal values. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and the information you provided today. Are there questions for these panelists? Thanks again. Representative Boquist, do you want to go ahead and try and amend spiritual values into this bill? I don't know that we can legislate. I don't think we can legislate spirituality. We'd like to be able to do that.
You can't legislate, but you can foster it or you can persecute.
Thank you.
Essentially, if you're polarizing.
We hope not to persecute it in the process. Mr. Marks, thank you again. And thank you, Jody, for bringing us a group from Tax Fairness for Oregon. And we'll go ahead, and colleagues, with your permission, I think what I'd like to do is have Representative Boquist and Representative Riley continue to work with the Legislative Revenue Office, if you would. I think you both have an interest in seeing this proceed forward much along the lines of what we've talked about, and I would encourage you to also work with J.L. Wilson from NFIB to see if we can't come up with a piece of legislation that could be amended here, and then I'd like you to take that to your caucuses as well to make sure that we can maybe get the votes to make it something that's revenue neutral in this process. But I don't want to presuppose what you'll come up with. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on 2629, and we will open a public hearing on, let's do this, colleagues, while we are all together. I'm going to jump out of order for just a moment on the schedule, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2452. Colleagues, on House Bill 2452, I am going to accept a motion to reconsider House Bill 2452.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2452 was passed to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger now requests that we reconsider our vote by which 2452 was passed to the House with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We will then open an actual work session as we move forward on House Bill 2452 once it's now back in the committee. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2452, this is the Department of Revenue bill, and it was the one that Representative Berger was going to carry, but it didn't even get filed, so everyone's clear. You know, it never went to the House floor. It didn't even get filed. The paperwork did not move beyond our office. So basically it was brought back because of some concern over some language that that there was wanted to be brought forward. So that's what you have in the Dash 1 amendment. So basically this again is dealing with those non-resident owners and who receive pass-through entity distributive income. And then the Department of Revenue was bringing forward this bill to deal with having composite filing and then also to have taxes withheld for those who aren't part of the composite filing. So basically with the Dash 1 amendment, I will say that this isn't sufficient in order to move the bill. At least there was concern over wanting some additional language in addition to the Dash 1 amendment that didn't get brought down to council. So this Dash 1 is not complete yet. So basically the Dash 1 is allowing a non-resident owner to file an affidavit with the Department of Revenue to determine and collect any of that income tax on the distributive income of a pass-through entity. But the Department of Revenue had also requested that they also be given the ability to reject the affidavit of the taxpayer under certain conditions. And that just is language that never got down to council until this morning. So basically we'll add that into the Dash 1 language in order to meet kind of both those needs. Both people are discussing it.
Colleagues, and let me explain to you that there were, after we had gaveled, closed, and had passed 2452 out of committee, there were folks that came forward and said, we think we can do this through a voluntary method whereby the department doesn't have to implement automatic withholding for those pass-through entities if those folks would, and I think you can read on the Dash 1 amendments of the 8th of this month, lines 3 through 9, basically they would file these kinds of affidavits to voluntarily agree to be submitting their entities and individuals to the laws of the state of Oregon for taxation purposes. It looked to me like that was the intention of the bill in the first place, to provide a yet another mechanism to go ahead and collect, voluntarily collect the taxes under the voluntary system. So with the understanding that the Department of Revenue will continue to work on this so that we can get this moved forward, have there been additional amendments or additional changes to the Dash 1 amendments ordered at this point, Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler, that's correct, yes. And okay. I can read the additional language if you want me to, but or else we can just deal with it when we get the Dash
1. Let's read the additional language.
Yeah, the additional language that's going to be added there is just saying that the department may reject the affidavit if the taxpayer fails to comply with Oregon tax laws requiring the filing of tax returns or the payment of any tax.
Okay, and colleagues, the concern was raised on the part of fairly substantial partnership, out-of-state partnerships that have substantial resources within the state of Oregon. I don't think that's I personally, as I look at it, don't think that this is a deal killer with regard to the folks that are involved in this. It would just make certain that they voluntarily come forward and the department plays a larger role in collecting the tax. And I think that it follows the spirit of 2452 as we've moved it out. So with that, Let's go ahead and put 2452 back, and we'll repost that for as quick as the amendment, the second amendment, comes out on 2452, and then we'll bring this back up for another work session to amend this bill and move it and get it back on its way. Again, thank you very much, Deborah, for working with us, and Richard for the other work that's done there. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2452, moving that bill for another later posting. Thank you again. Okay, colleagues, we were scheduled today for public hearing possible work session on House Bill 2542. My wife says that I'm dyslexic when I give her these numbers, 2542 and 2452. Would you join with me then as we go ahead then and open the public hearing on House Bill 2452 and 2542. I'm not good with numbers. What we did was we asked for a panel to come forward. And we appreciate Lori Wimmer Whalen's ability to gather these folks together. And Lori, would you bring forward your panel today? And we appreciate you folks taking your time to come and give us your thoughts on 2542.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, representing 43,000 members in K-12 and community colleges, and also chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, which is an ad hoc group of folks who are interested in revenue issues. And we have over 75 people on our mailing list, and I have, with my testimony, given you a sheet of the official members of the Revenue Coalition so you know who those folks are. We are here today to talk to you a little bit about the ReConnect legislation you've all been considering the last couple days. And I have written testimony that goes into a fair amount of detail about the two areas of concern that we have. I'd like to just say for the record that we support the changes made by the federal government with respect to the cancellation of the extraterritorial income exclusion and the revenue recapture that Oregon would realize if we connected to that provision, as well as some tax sheltering that they canceled at the federal level as well. But we do have some questions regarding two other provisions, and one of those is what is being called QPI, which is the Qualified Production Activities Income. This is the manufacturing tax break many of you have probably heard about. And the second is our connection to health savings accounts. And I have with me two other people who have a lot more expertise on both of those issues who will also submit testimony. But let me just briefly review for you the amendments we would like, which would be to decouple from those two provisions. We feel very strongly about those because of the revenue involved for the state of Oregon, both for the upcoming 05-07 biennium and in the out years. In the next 4 years alone, the first one, the QPI deduction, would drill a $45 million hole in the budget over the next 4 years in Oregon's income tax revenues. We think this decoupling from the single largest tax break for corporate America in years would protect the state from that revenue loss. And so we would recommend that Oregon follow Republican Governor Mitt Romney's lead when he had the same proposal for the Massachusetts legislature, which they adopted, and now a number of states are considering similar action. We believe that the QPI deduction should not be considered a swap for the extraterritorial income exclusion being canceled. And the reason for that is it typically affects different taxpayers. So it's not, and also it's not the same amount of money. However you might decide with respect to the reconnection issues on this matter, we think it's very important to decouple those two pieces and not see them as a package deal, because in effect the cancellation of the one sort of disguises the fact that we would be adding to Oregon's 352 tax expenditures by instituting QPI in Oregon's tax breaks that we give to corporations. And we think that deserves a standalone conversation as a policy a policy conversation. We also believe that the QPI would not have a direct relationship to creation of jobs or stimulation of the economy of Oregon. As you read through this document, you'll see that the QPI phases in. That's a 3%, then 6%, and then 9% at full implementation, I think, by 2010. That means it's a tiny amount of money on the books for the corporations who would be subject to it. And by the way, I would point out to you, our sole Fortune 500 company, Nike, would not be subject to QPI. They would not be allowed to take it because they are not a manufacturing apparel design, and that is not one of the creative services that's been carved out in this exemption. So just to give you an illustration, that's not even a company, nor would Columbia Sportswear, for example, another key industry in Oregon. So we think that the revenue loss to core services in Oregon would be substantial, obviously, $18 million in the next biennium and $27 million in the year, 2 years after that. And so, obviously, core services would suffer from the loss of that revenue in the state coffers, but it wouldn't necessarily provide much to any individual corporation at the state level. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Chuck Shakatov, who is here from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and then to Tim Nesbitt, who can go into more detail on both of these provisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Chuck Shakatov, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I want to begin by telling you that hopefully by the end of this week, depending on when we receive them, we'll be providing the committee and all members of the House and Senate copies of this report by Robert Lynch, who's the chair of the Economics Department at Washington College, called Rethinking Growth Strategies, How State and Local Taxes and Services Affect Economic Development. And I think it's a good quick read. One of the things that jumped out at me was that taxes, if you look at all state and local taxes for businesses, they're typically about 0.8% of their cost of doing business. And so it really puts in perspective the role that taxes play in business decisions. We think that the legislature ought to disconnect from the and deal with the extraterritorial income exclusion, the WTO said it violates international law and we should get rid of our liability Oregon may have. I don't believe that's a 3/5 vote. I think there's plenty of reasons other than raising revenue to get out of that, although it does bring in more revenue. We don't think it should be a swap for the qualified productions activities income for a variety of reasons, some of which were touched on by Lori. It's much more costly over time. It's not the same businesses. Extraterritorial income deals with exports. This deals with domestic production, not just manufacturing. QPI is much more costly over time than extraterritorial income. If you don't connect to that, you'll have money for other investments in the state, which we sorely need and the business community wants, such as investments in higher education. And there's a little economic justification for giving this tax break for certain businesses and not others. And it has lots of compliance problems. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities released a report recently explaining this, which is available on their website. It's called States Can Decouple from the Qualified Production Activities Income Deduction. It was released in early February. And they point out that the IRS has even identified, the IRS Commissioner Mark Everson has identified compliance problems. And an Oregon economist, Kimberly Clausing from Reed College in Portland, wrote a paper for the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center on the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. And she notes in that the following. The bill would create compliance and enforcement difficulties as firms would have incentives to characterize as much income as possible as production income. For instance, firms could be motivated to make those divisions subject to favorable tax treatment more profitable than those that do not receive such treatment. By shifting paper profits among divisions, firms can reduce their overall tax liability. Such efforts will lead to unnecessary accounting and compliance costs for firms and unnecessary enforcement costs for the IRS, and I would argue for the state as well. For example, she notes, the New York Times reported that Starbucks successfully added a provision to the bill that deems coffee roasting, but not coffee preparation, a manufacturing activity. This provision gives Starbucks a tax incentive to increase the bean prices charged to its retail outlets, making the roasting part of the business more profitable and the retail part of the business less profitable. Such efforts could decrease Starbucks' tax bill, but serve no other discernible public purpose. So it's encouraging. QPI is encouraging a whole bunch of accounting changes and ways that certain companies will be able to take advantage of it, but it doesn't bring necessarily one net job. As Lori mentioned, Republican Governor Mitt Romney submitted a bill to the Massachusetts legislature to disconnect from this, and they did do that, and that's become law there. It's easy to disconnect. A lot of states disconnect on a variety of things, many more things than we've disconnected on. 31 states decoupled from the bonus depreciation enacted a few years ago. 18 states decoupled from the Section 189 expensing. It can happen. The companies that are most affected by these are multi-state corporations. They deal with multi-state tax codes. They have the accounting capabilities to deal with filing the forms here in Oregon. As a matter of course, it's a huge tax cut, and I really do think you need to look at the out years, because over time, because of the phase-in of the federal QPI provisions, it's going to get more and more costly to Oregon over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jack?
Tim? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon, and speaking to one particular aspect of the problems that arise when we are automatically connected to federal tax policy and blindly follow that policy. And those problems can result both on the policy side, which I want to address when I talk about health savings accounts, as well as on the revenue side. I feel like this testimony is more appropriate for a health policy committee of this chamber, but if I can at least give you the overview of what we're dealing with here when we talk about health savings accounts. These are new tax-sheltered accounts that serve as the foundation for high-deductible health plans. In order to qualify for tax-exempt treatment of funds that are contributed to a health savings account, HSA, a participant must enroll in a health insurance plan with an annual deductible that is at least $1,000 for an individual or $2,000 for a family of two or more persons, which is substantially higher than what I think most working people in Oregon now have in their health plans. These deductible amounts then must be met before a participant may claim benefits under the insurance plan. The HSA itself is designed then to receive and spend funds to cover expenses subject to the deductible, and there are a few other kinds of expenses that can be made when you're laid off and on a corporate plan, for instance. So there are other, it's not strictly expenses that can cover premiums in certain cases, but it can't cover your ordinary premium month to month if you're employed.
Tim, can I just stop right there?
Yeah.
And ask you, and I reviewed this with Lori the other day when she told me about the HSA and not desiring to encourage it as an Oregon activity, but my concern is, would you discourage your members from participating in an HSA if they could participate in it?
Representative Butler, the attached memo is our advice to our members.
Okay.
And we do discourage their participation because of the structure of the high deductible plan, because of the fact that it's likely to shift more and more costs to plan participants away from employers to employees over time. It will have adverse impact. It have adverse selection impacts on most group health plans. It is likely because you're going to end up with two kinds of accounts, both of which have to be managed by a third party, both your HSA and your standard insurance plan, to actually result in higher administrative costs over time.
So,
and everything on page 5 through 8 of the attachment gives you the rationales for why we would discourage. Now, if I could anticipate another question, since this is a tax advantage account under the federal tax code, the dog, and we're the tail of the dog, or maybe we're the hindquarters, because we're probably about a quarter of total tax bill here. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to say how should we try and participate or not participate, follow or not follow a decision being made because of the greater impact of federal tax consequences. I don't know that I have a good answer for you on that, but I do have an alternative to saying no. I list for you a number of primary concerns that we have, which if you didn't want to say no to health savings accounts in Oregon. You could at least say yes to them under certain conditions. And as a fallback, if you just don't want to strictly disconnect from them, we think that this a whole scheme around health savings accounts is flawed and problematic. Nonetheless, it can be made a little less problematic if, for instance, we make sure that the money you're spending from your health savings account, if you're participating in a high deductible health plan, there's a question here about whether you're, when you're spending for services from your own pocket, you're going to get the rates negotiated by an insurance plan, or are you just on your own as an individual? That's a worst case scenario. That could be a condition where we say, no, it's got to be, your deductible has to be built into whatever provider rates are negotiated in your basic benefit plan. Because otherwise, you're not getting any benefits until you spend $2,000 for your family. And that's, by the way, the threshold. Some of these plans will be much higher than that in terms of the structure of the deductible.
I'm just anxious to know, and I appreciate pointing out that this attachment is something that you're recommending to your members, that they relative to their participation in an HSA. Please proceed.
And so, again, going to the what if we say yes but or yes if, another big question arises around preventive care benefits and whether those would have to be paid for out of your own pocket or out of your own HSA and not covered by the insurance plan. The federal law leaves that as a optional arrangement. We could in Oregon tell employers, if you want to participate in an HSA, you got to make sure that the preventive benefits, everything from well baby care to regular checkups, are not something that you'd have to pay out of pocket, but would be part of the basic benefit of the plan. And
let me just ask another question. Couldn't your members use this following retirement, that because the benefits are cumulative, they could certainly use that, particularly with regard to that portion of the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement Modernization Act of 2003 and being implemented in 2004, they could certainly use the benefits of it, couldn't they, for their prescriptions?
And we can certainly find examples where if you have been in an HSA for a period of time, you've been lucky and healthy, you haven't had a lot of expenses, you could be one of those in the advantage category and have some money to spend upon retirement. By the way, we also call attention to the fact that separately in our tax code, we have a senior medical deduction. And we have nothing that I see by connecting to the federal on HSAs that say you can't, in effect, get double credits here, get tax-exempt expenditures from your HSA, and get the senior medical deduction. So we're calling that to your attention here, too. I mean, these are the things that kind of flow from automatically connecting, which I'm raising basic policy questions about why we have HSAs, but we also have implementation questions. And we have that gray area in between where we could say in Oregon that if you're an employer setting up an HSA, do it this way, where you're covering the preventive benefits.
I appreciate you bringing that up. We'll address that.
Okay. So that's the gist of my testimony. Bottom line is we prefer you not do it. I understand if you think the weight of the federal change is going to draw employers into this anyway. If that's the case, let's set some conditions so we do it in a better way than we otherwise would.
Thank you very much. Lori, was it you that was giving me the statistics on the number of companies that are participating or receiving the money under the Medicare Drug Prescription Act? Or was that information that we received? Do you have that information?
Chairman Butler, no, I don't. And that was kind of a survey, wasn't it, that
yes,
they were
going to
do? And I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard the survey, and it's not even 60%, as I recall, that may be participating. In other words, folks are just saying the cost of prescription drugs are becoming very, very expensive for us. So Tim, I don't know how many folks you represent in the state of Oregon. Certainly with your affiliates, it's got to be in the hundreds of thousands. And so
180,000 members and their family members would bring the covered lives, as they say in the business, above 300,000.
Yeah, and if we're talking about 300,000 direct lives that might have, and they're all earning working people that might have benefits under the HSA, with companies looking at this and saying, we don't think we can afford those rich benefits into the future, then I just question, and you brought up some good points, but my concern was, should we be telling folks, don't participate in this because we really don't like it at this end when it might create some benefit from them. As you say, there may be nothing there when they retire, but I'm looking at it and saying most of those folks may have other health benefits that they wouldn't have to dip into that HSA during their working lifetimes either, in which case it becomes cumulative. And then, as you say, when they turn, 58, I guess, and can then deduct the benefits or receive the full benefit of it on their organ return for their medical, then at that particular point, they could be in an excellent position to use the resources that they would have been able to accumulate income tax-free out of an HSA, both for federal and for state at that point. But then if we didn't connect for state, I'm wondering if we've got a taxable situation at that point, too. So
If I may respond, I think trying to frame the policy issues, do HSAs encourage cost shifting or do they ameliorate the effects of cost shifting that's already on the horizon? I think it's a little of both.
That's a great chicken and egg question.
I do very much worry, though, about since you have to go to $2,000 minimum deductible for a family. Most of our members are at $500 a year. Imagine that bite in that first year when now you got to cover the first $2,000 of expense. And it's a family-wide deductible. It's not by anyone. It's a family-wide deductible. It's a different design than we usually see. That's why we're so concerned about the immediate effects. If, though, it is some amelioration because you're able to put money in your account and now it's tax-free, then instead of standing against the tide, if I can use another metaphor, maybe we should channel the incoming tide here and say, well, okay, employers in Oregon, here's how to structure it. And that's what we're offering as a solution.
Thank you very much. Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that concerns me is I see the possibility that with the health savings accounts, if we don't require basic preventive medicine benefits, that people will not do those, that they'll say, oh, I used to get this under my insurance policy and I got my 2-year checkup or whatever it was, but now it's going to come out of my pocket and I won't get those checkups. And I'm concerned about that. Do you see that as a
Representative, yes, we do, and I think this is a great opportunity where, you know, if an employer is just now thinking of setting up an HSA in Oregon, and we want them to do it that way because it's, we think, a better way to go, then we're using our tax code to influence how the program is designed in a way I think that'll be better in the long run for participants.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Hatz.
There may be some confusion. Tim, are you you're weighing in on the individual HSAs and not on the corporate Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement Modernization Act, the subsidies, correct?
My understanding is that the health savings accounts were set up in the Medicare bill, and apart from any corporate subsidies for which employers are participating in the retiree prescription drug programs, that's a whole other issue. HSAs are designed for employment-based health plans as well as for individual plans, and our concern is based on the impacts on current policies affecting employment-based health plans.
Okay. Mr. Chair, maybe Elizabeth, or Paul, maybe Elizabeth is straightened out. We have these listed as two different categories.
And Representative Hatz, it's just mainly because it is the same bill, but it one's corporate tax change versus just looking at individual personal income tax change. And also the health is what we've discussed before, but the health savings accounts we've already connected to. You know, that is part of the medical savings accounts and other savings accounts that we have in our automatic reconnect provision. So that's why it's on your front side. The health savings accounts are on your front, on the first page of your list of different policy changes versus your second page where you're going to need to then connect to these through House Bill 2542.
Right. And we have a revenue impact of minus $9 million for the corporate. HSA version,
and that's just for the subsidies that are going to the corporations.
That's a separate matter, Representative.
That's why I was just wondering. You were testifying that not on that matter.
That's correct. And my understanding is we had a $4 million revenue impact next biennium from this one.
Yes, that's correct.
Three point seven
for 507 biennium, and then 0305 it was like 1.7.
I see.
So there's two parts.
And then, Lori, as I read your presentation here, if employers are given an incentive to cancel traditional health insurance coverage, it may be that organ workers who are injured or seriously ill would be unable to ultimately cover medical expenses from their HSA account. Is that because the HSA account would run out?
Mr. Chair, we were hypothesizing the case of a severe burn victim or cancer or something like that. You could ultimately bottom out your account. And ultimately, if also you were no longer covered by a traditional medical plan because your employer has gone to this instead of providing the traditional coverage.
But as Tim has indicated, it's kind of a back end of the whole problem because the feds, their rates are much higher than ours, and the incentive appears to be much greater for folks to examine the HSA as a potential. So that I understand, then the establishment of new health and savings accounts that you show as a $3.8 million cost in the 0507 is actually the individuals setting money aside and health savings accounts and receiving the deductions. As they set aside money for health coverage, do we have any idea what the balance of health care insurance individuals are setting aside for just insurance, traditional insurance packages, how much that value is to individuals in lost taxation in the state of Oregon? Because that would be that would probably be easily 10 or 15 times this amount.
Right.
And this, I saw the HSA as a as an additional alternative for folks to set money aside for their health care needs. I guess I need a little bit more insight into the actual mechanical working of that before I formulate it.
If I may add one other point, employers who then pay lesser premiums because now there's a higher deductible plan and presumably they get a quote for a lower premium. You have that advantage. They also may choose to put money into the employee's account. And if they do, then that's tax sheltered the same way a health expense would be. And so there may be a shifting of employer tax effort, but on both sides, in both forms, it's tax sheltered.
And let me ask staff, then, that's what represents then the $9.2 million on the corporate side is the encouragement to put money into the HSAs on behalf of their employees.
Chairman Butler, what the companies are going to get is payments from Medicare for keeping that drug plan.
That's exactly right.
And so that's payments from Medicare, and that is, like Deborah was testifying to, that's be tracked by Medicare and stuff at the federal level.
I recall it now. That was my recollection of the 9.2. Where is the corporate tax benefit that they would have in setting aside money for the employees, Tim has indicated?
Well, Chairman Butler, then on this front side, then, you also have that indirect tax effect from reductions in employer costs. That is also from the Medicare prescription drug. And that is, again, employers will be have an incentive by moving some of their higher cost employees that they don't want to have prescription drugs plans at a certain level, then they'll have them, they'll reduce their own cost by not providing those plans any longer. And then that's the additional tax revenue you'll see on the corporate side.
By virtue of the fact they're not expending that on behalf of their employees.
Yes, and then they're getting the federal subsidies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bradley.
But that never answered the question about where is the expense of the employers contributing to the individual plans for them.
Yeah, Representative Riley, I could look into that as far as whether or not that's captured all in this health savings accounts, because it may just be part of what they're anticipating will be the amount that employers will be able to have in that account as a deduction.
Okay, maybe that's a netted number that you're working off of in order to get the Oregon, the $3.752 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you could check on that, I appreciate it.
Yeah. I think that does bear additional examination. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thanks. Tim, did you weigh in on the QPI listing there in terms of whether Oregon should decouple from that?
We agree with the former testimony and would like to see us decouple from that provision.
I think that the information from the Oregon Revenue Coalition, I think, Lori, you're presenting this on behalf of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Education Association as well as the Revenue Coalition.
Okay, so the OEA and the Oregon Revenue Coalition and the AFL-CIO is a member of the coalition.
Just one follow-up.
Yes, please follow up, Representative.
Technical question, Mr. Sheketoff. You suggested not only decoupling from QPI, but also from ETI, which there's like a double negative there. It's already been repealed federally, so why would we not want to repeal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, members of the committee, 1997, Oregon changed the law to have automatic rolling reconnect. It did something that had been done in the 80s and was repealed in sometime in the mid-80s, late 80s. And so we run rolling reconnect. The last legislature tied to the December 31st, 2002 tax code and gave a sunset to that at the end of this year, I believe. And so one decision you could do, so we're not coupled. We are coupled as of December 32. We're not doing rolling reconnect anymore, current law today. So one decision, the way that was designed with the future date of when the sunset is by a simple majority, this committee could extend that sunset from end of this year to two more years out. Simple majority. That's how former Representative and Chair Lane Shetterly and your staff, Paul Warner and others, designed that. So it would be a simple majority to end the rolling reconnect. So that's one option. And then you say, okay, what do we do on extraterritorial income exclusion? We're tied to the federal law as it exists that day, December 31st, 2002. Well, the federal law, because of WTO, is going away, right? So you have to make a separate decision. Do we disconnect from that, okay? And do we now reconnect a later date, okay? And so that's a separate decision. You could just pass two bills, two simple majority votes. One, extending the sunset of the bill that connected up to us at the end of 2002, which from the end of this year out 2 or 4 or 5 years, and we'd be connected to the 2002 code, okay? And then you could separately, with a simple majority, I believe, address the extraterritorial income exclusion, even though it raises revenue for the state. There's no question the state will get more money as a result. But you could put one or more whereas clauses about the reason you're doing it, and one of them is the WTO declaration that it's illegal and that you're protecting the interests of the state. And then QPI doesn't apply in everything. Today, the law, they cannot take advantage of QPI. You have to act to let them do that as of today. Okay, because you're connected as of December 2002. And so it's a little confusing. We're not doing reconnect law as of today. Now, that expires. It's sunsetted. Some of us wanted just rolling reconnect ended outright, but that was not the compromise that was reached last session. So you could keep December 2002 as your connection date and extend it so that goes past the end of this year. That's a simple vote, simple majority vote.
But not simple.
Nothing in this building is simple.
Thanks.
If I may,
please, Chuck.
It's related to a bill dealt with a couple bills ago. You know, on the estate tax, we cannot do rolling reconnect. You outright can't under the state constitution. But only it's on the income tax, and there's one other sort of narrow area of law that we can that legislative councils identified. In our constitution. So, you know, this is one where you're dealing with, because of the fiscal situation, I think was the pressure last session and post 2002 special sessions that no one enjoyed, I think. They said, okay, let's not do rolling reconnects, let's protect the fisc over the next couple years. And so you connect it as of December 2002.
perhaps it was anticipated that we would have recovered our revenue much more rapidly than where we're at today. I think that was originally part of the thinking for the other issues in compromise. Let me just ask this, the statement continues to roll that you discourage that which you attempt to tax. I'd like your response to that, and particularly with regard to the discouragement of connecting with the QPI.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think that's sort of one of those mythological statements when you look at businesses and business taxes, and especially when you look at the Lynch report that says overall state and local taxes and federal taxes are 0.8%. But you can also look here in Oregon. If you go to Intel's website and you read the history of why Intel came to Oregon, let me read you a few excerpts. Intel landed on Oregon's radar when a member of Tektronix board interested in expanding Oregon's high technology universe called Intel's co-founder, Gordon Moore. Quote, "You should consider Portland. It's a good quality of life and a good labor pool," Keith Thompson, a former Intel site manager, recalls. "We were looking for a place within an hour or two by airplane from San Jose." In describing the period of 1970 to 1980, they say, they talk about Oregon was being fortunate to attract several other high-tech companies, and they say, "Oregon's workforce, abundance of pure water, K-life education system, quality of life, and proximity to the Silicon Valley made it an ideal place to do business." In a 1974 article in the Oregonian, they quote on their webpage, "Oregon is one of the few places we found where people still take pride in their work. This state has a stable, well-trained labor force. As a growing company, we have to be assured of a supply of energy. We couldn't get that assurance in the Bay Area, but we got it here." And then last, they point out that in 1982, when there was a recession and the legislature was cutting something, the high-tech industry had a consistent response. "We need quality education research resources nearby." And they boast about the fact that the only added spending that happened during those special sessions of 1982 was new money creating the Oregon Consortium of High Technology. Intel's payroll in Oregon increased from 19, and these are based on Echo Northwest reports on the economic impacts of Intel. Their payroll increased, their total compensation package for Oregon increased 134% between 1997 and 2001. Okay? Their taxes went down about 5%. Their taxes in 1997 were about 1/12 of their payroll. If you compare the ratio of compensation, it's not a big taxes are not the big expense.
Aren't taxes a function of profitability,
Mr. Chairman? They are a function of profitability, but as in terms of expenses to the business, taxes have always been and always will be a very small expense as far as their decision. Now, right now, Intel, for instance, is down in Arizona trying to get the Arizona legislature to enact single sales factor. Okay? And they're saying to Intel, to the Arizona legislature, "Give us this or we're going to build in Oregon." And they're saying to Washington County, "Give us an extension of our strategic investment program or we're going to build in Arizona." They're playing the two states off each other. And just taxes and the big scheme of things really don't matter. They have other more important expenses, our quality of life, our good labor force, our quality of water, our low energy costs, a whole bunch of things led to them coming here and staying here and developing here.
You know, perhaps we'll have those folks come and tell us whether or not it's important that we have a proper tax environment in Oregon as well as the rest of it. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much, Lori. We appreciate your bringing that. We'll go ahead then and let's see. We do have. Thank you. Let's go ahead then with that.
Chairman Butler, I just wanted to make sure that everyone has in front of you with House Bill 2542. Estimates. I didn't change any of these numbers, but there is one addition, and I want to have just a brief discussion just because we did discuss it the last time when Deborah testified from the Department of Revenue, but we need to make you all aware that what she was talking about is how they're going to interpret current law is that sales taxes now, which are going to be allowed a deduction in lieu of income tax deduction, that's a provision in the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. So what we're going to do then here in Oregon, without any changes in the bill, what we're going to have is sales taxes then that will be deducted at the federal level in lieu of income taxes, but they're not going to be added back for Oregon purposes. Now, under current law, we have everyone who has an income tax deduction add that back to their Oregon taxable income when they start figuring Oregon tax. Okay, you're not allowed a state income tax deduction here in Oregon, only at the federal level.
Right.
So what you're going to have, though, are sales taxes then that are going to be deducted at the federal level, and then they're not going to be added back here in Oregon. Then what you get is a loss in revenue because you not only have income taxes that now won't be added back, but you also have sales taxes that will be a deduction at the federal level, which will fall right through to Oregon and not added back on the state return. So you have a reduction there, and it's mainly the low-income non-residents who don't have real big income tax burdens here in Oregon. They're going to be affected by this. So I just went through and estimated how much sales tax burden versus income tax burden there would be for different taxpayer groups, and then I came up with a revenue loss there then of $569,000 and then $607,000 in 05-07 biennium. And just recognize this is just 2 years.
So this is for the sales tax. Is this taken into consideration more than Washington? Is also California?
It's any non-resident. Okay. That's right.
Right.
It's just basically looking at non-residents having the opportunity to have paid sales taxes because the neighboring states.
But the income tax that we pick up from the neighboring states has got to be in excess of $100 million.
Oh, yes. But Chairman Butler, this is, first of all, it's only those that itemize.
Right.
Second of all, it's only those with some low, I mean, if you basically are paying a lot of income taxes here in Oregon and you're a non-resident, you're not going to choose a sales tax. I mean, the sales tax really, that tax burden is only going to be bigger than your income tax burden for a small group, and that's, I think the margin was right around $20,000, so if you had an income of less than $20,000, then basically you would be paying more in sales taxes than you would in income taxes.
I'm trying to work that out, though. Because they itemize and deduct the state income tax, Oregon state income tax, then, they would deduct that always in lieu of the sales tax, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Because it would always be much higher.
Right.
And then they have to back that out on the face of their Oregon.
That is, you know, if this is something that you don't want to have this way, then we need an amendment. Do you want to have an additional $1 million for the 03-05 and then the 05-07? And this could be larger. We recognize this is just 2 years. It just had a very strong, very short sunset in federal law because it was a quite costly provision. So they basically could be extending this in the future.
Do we open ourselves up for more border wars if we don't do it? That's my concern.
Well, Chairman Butler, I think they're not going to be happy with this, right? Non-residents? they're not going to like it that they would have to add back their sales tax deduction, that they're going to be able to claim at the federal level. Then in Oregon, they wouldn't have to add that back.
Right.
So they're not going to... The way this is right now, this is a benefit to non-residents.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to treat it the same, this would really be a tax fairness issue in terms of treating sales taxes the same as income taxes, since that's the way the federal government viewed it, is sales tax in lieu of income tax deduction. Then you would have to add them back to Oregon income, just like you do with your income tax.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hess.
Does that federal law say that you pick one or the other?
Correct.
Okay. So if Oregon had, say, a sales tax and then, say, an income tax of about half of what it is now, you wouldn't add those two. You would just pick the highest.
The higher.
Right.
But then on the face of the Oregon, you're going to have to probably pull either one of them out if we ended up with a sales tax in Oregon at that point, to be consistent with the policy that we've had in the past and not being able to deduct the state tax.
Yeah.
Okay, other questions of staff? You've got the -1 and -2 report at that
point.
So then we
can go through these amendments. And basically, there's two amendments before you, and this sheet right here just kind of at least gives you a summary of the two. Okay, so the common components that are in the -1 and -2 amendments is you've got that clarifying language then for child, for the working family child care credit. So I'll just kind of look briefly at the dash one, then you see that's lines 5 through 7 of that amendment, where basically you're saying that the it isn't just the child of the taxpayer, it's a person who has a relationship to the taxpayer that is described in that Internal Revenue Code of the qualifying dependent. So that language is in both amendments. Then you have the conforms the Oregon law to the federal law pertaining to particular corporate dividends received that are excluded from qualifying for a dividend deduction under federal law. So basically that's further down here in the dash one, that 19, line 19 through, basically the rest of through the next 7 lines of page 2. But what we are including is broader than the REITs. So as we had talked about before, we talked about the REITs being the component in House Bill 2542. This broadens this dividend deduction exclusion to conform with federal law. It includes all of those dividends that are excluded at the federal level in Section 243 as well as Section 965 of the Internal Revenue Code. And why we're referring to section is because we're also conforming then to the new provisions that are in that American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. They created a new section for these dividends that are getting that temporary 85% deduction. Well, that's the 965 section of the Internal Revenue Code. So that's why we're going to be conforming then to federal tax purposes for those REITs and then those dividends from foreign-controlled corporations. This dash 1 and dash 2 both provide the 85% dividend deduction that the federal government is providing for temporarily, okay? And then once that period of time is over, which is, roughly a year, you're going to then be not giving any you're not going to be giving any dividends received deduction for foreign controlled corporations. So that'll be the change from current law, because under current law, we're still giving a 70 or 80% deduction. So this would be eliminating that, as well as eliminating the 70 or 80% dividends deduction for those REITs received also. So basically, that's what the dash 1 and 2, the common element. And then the only difference between the dash 1 and the dash 2 is the dash 1 is reestablishing then a rolling reconnect to the federal definition of taxable income for federal tax law purposes changes after January 1st, 2005. So the language that basically it's using there is on the first page, lines 12 through 17, where basically it's saying that the Internal Revenue Code is that is amended and in effect on December 31st, 2004, or if related to the definition of taxable income as applicable to tax year of the taxpayer. So basically the rolling reconnect language of any tax year, those changes would be incorporated into Oregon law if it's relating to the definition of taxable income. So that's where the rolling reconnect provision is established there. And so since you have the rolling reconnect, then you're capturing all the things that we talked about in terms of like amortization and the military compensation benefits. If any of that is going to be affecting taxable income base, then that is something that we will be connecting to just due to this having the rolling reconnect provisions. And then with the dash 2 amendment, all we're doing there is we don't have the rolling reconnect in January 1st, 2005. We have just allowed additional components there to have the automatic connection. And those components are amortization and then the definitions pertaining to taxable income in the dash 2 amendment. And that's like line 14 there. And that was basically trying to deal with some of the issues with S corporations or things like that we might have some definitions that pertain to taxable income that we might be able to connect to. And then also the military compensation benefits, those we would automatically connect to with the dash 2 as well. So basically that's the difference between those two. And then just one other piece of paper I gave you, just because we had been talking quite a bit about the military issue and whether or not if we have any connection to future federal military compensation changes, then I just gave you this brief little chart here. And this just shows you, and I haven't looked in this in great detail or anything, but if you had death benefits of $100,000, and those were all then excluded from the federal definition of taxable income. And again, with the dash one and dash two, if we connect to these kind of changes, then you'd see a reduction there of $239,360 in 04-05, and then $35,000 in 05-06, and then for the whole 2005-07 biennium, $67,584, and then we go down to $53,504 in the 2007-09 biennium. But recognize this is on a separate sheet of paper, and it's meant to be separate from anything that we have right now associated with House Bill 2542, because this will only become part of the revenue impact for this bill as if this federal legislation passes between now and when we leave the building. Okay, then I would add it into the revenue impact for House Bill 2542 if we adopt the dash one or dash two amendment. So just be clear, I don't incorporate this until it actually becomes law. And once we get amendments in the bill that actually conform to those provisions. So as far as the revenue impact itself, I've just given you the dash one and dash two, and they're both the same revenue impact. It's the same that we saw the other day, just because these were the amendments that I was needing in order to make the calculations that I did under the different scenarios. So basically, as we had before, in the 05-07 biennium, the total revenue impact from corporate and personal is a reduction of $14.6 million, and then the 05-07 biennium, a reduction of $5.5 million. So that's it.
Questions? Come on.
Really well.
I'm not going to ask you how you derive that military compensation. Okay.
All right. We can
that's the question. No, that's not the question I want to ask right now. Being no further questions, I don't think anybody indicated they're ready to just vote on this right now. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2542, and there being nothing further before us, adjourn this meeting to the House Revenue. Oh, there is something.
Yeah, I just want to remind the committee we've got a field trip scheduled for 1 o'clock. On Friday,
okay.
To review their processing, we meet there at 1 o'clock.
Okay, that doesn't need to be on the record. We were adjourned.
Madam Chair, only if I'm back from